More than 3 million women have served in the military since the American Revolution. And a memorial at the Arlington National Cemetery aims to give women veterans the recognition they deserve.
Truly, I think women have been the unsung patriots, you know, in our military heritage, because there just wasn't anything much out there to tell our stories.
Plus, a 31-foot statue of Abraham Lincoln called Return Visit has moved from Michigan Avenue in Chicago to Peoria's riverfront. Here's Peoria Riverfront Museum's president, John Morris.
Return Visit also has kind of a nice connotation to just returning to history. History is about the present. It informs the present and inspires the future.
But first, we'll get an update on Illinois' solar industry as one company considers building a solar farm in Peoria County. That's all coming up in this hour on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Yvonne Greer in for Nyla Boodoo. Solar farms use mirrors and solar panels to utilize the sun's energy for electricity. This process can reduce costs for farmers and ultimately reduce the cost of food for consumers. A solar farm could be coming to central Illinois. Earlier this month, some farmers in Peoria County got letters of interest from a North Carolina-based company called Cypress Creek Renewables. Illinois is about the middle of the road nationwide in terms of producing solar energy, with enough power to power about 9,500 homes. But as it gets less expensive to convert light into electricity, that amount is set to grow. I'm joined now by Matt Budell. He's a reporter with the Peoria Journal-Star. Also on the line is Klaus Weber, an associate producer of management and organizations at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. Matt, Klaus, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Matt, I'd like to start with you. As I said in that brief introduction, you reported this story after a number of farmers in Peoria County got letters of interest from that North Carolina-based company, Cypress Creek. Do you know what those letters said?
They were letters of interest, as I understand them, and I believe that they went to not just farmers in Peoria County, but in some surrounding counties as well. I think that there were also landowners in Caswell, Fulton, and Knox counties that received letters of interest. They were pretty specific in terms of identifying plots of land that Cypress Creek was interested in, and they contained some general terms of a potential lease. I believe that the company was looking for leases of up to 40 years, and they were talking about $800, I think, per acre.
So how big a project might this be? How much land would be taken up? How much power could be supplied by it?
The total megawatt wasn't necessarily thrown out there. They're looking at several small installations, anywhere from 2 megawatts to 20 megawatts a piece. And it generally broke down to like a 20 megawatt wind farm installation. I'm sorry, solar farm installation would take up around 200 acres. I think is the term that they threw out there.
So for a project like this to go through, all the farmers and the people who own land in Peoria County and the other places that received these letters of intent, they would have to make arrangements with Cypress Creek. Have you spoken to anyone? Do you think this is something that the farmers in this area are open to?
The couple of landowners who I've spoken to, they were interested in it for a couple of reasons. You know, one of them specifically was looking for just a way to monetize his property and monetize it long term. You know, the price of commodities isn't it's not what it used to be. And he was leasing a lot of that property anyway. So the land that he was leasing was going for about $200 an acre for the season, mm-hmm. As opposed to, you know, locking in a 40-year term at $800 an acre. I mean, that's a fairly significant increase.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, from that person's perspective, there certainly was interest. I know that there may not be as much interest from adjacent landowners if those people aren't interested in seeing solar panels on the farm next to them. But the Cypress Creek folks who I spoke to also said that early on in the development process, they would be, once they identified specific parcels where they intended to move forward with installing solar panels, they would be in contact with adjacent property owners to try to answer any of their questions as well.
Klaus, if you would paint the picture for me, what would a solar farm look like to some of those adjacent property owners that might be concerned about how much space this might take up and how obtrusive it might be to the eye?
Yeah, I think it depends largely on how large an installation it is. I think many of the solar development we will see in Illinois will be relatively small scales, around maybe 2 megawatts, which is really where a lot of the incentives have gone towards distributed and community-based solar, which would be smaller scale. So for 2 megawatts, you would probably use about 6-7 acres. The larger one, which seems what they might have in mind, in Peoria, would be significantly larger. And what you basically envision is a pretty much completely covered area that basically has solar voltaic panels all around. It's not terribly visible from afar because they're normally relatively flat. But if you're right next to it, obviously it's it looks like it's paved, the farmland. So it's definitely visible. But it depends a little bit on how large the installation is and whether it's split up into several smaller ones.
Do you know why Central Illinois might be so attractive a target?
I would think it's attractive for a number of reasons. One is that there's demand as industry, so there's local demand for solar, for any renewable. There's also land, the availability of land, especially for solar and wind. You need a certain size land without... it's very difficult to do solar in densely populated areas unless it's on the rooftop of manufacturing plants, for example. And a lot of it would be driven by the cost of the property, by the cost of the land, because the jobs bill, the new energy jobs bill, doesn't really make any distinction where exactly solar installations would be. You get the same price for the energy, and so it's a matter of the inputs, including how expensive the land is, how easy it is to develop, the regulations, and things like that.
I understand. So where are we now in terms of how viable solar power is as a long-term energy source?
Well, the bill really sort of turned a switch in Illinois, because to be honest, the amount of solar energy produced in Illinois right now is really minute. It's very, very little. Most of it is nuclear. It's a lot of coal. And the big factor for solar and to some extent wind is really the price of natural gas, which has really dropped the price for energy production a lot. And so it has to compete against that. And then the incentives that the state in this case will provide. So I think the bill is fairly long-term, and I would think that the incentives remain. But the bill also includes a provision that the actual price for that you could get for producing renewable energy will be revisited every 2 years. And so there's a little bit of uncertainty about how strong of an incentive those prices will be. A significant increase in solar and wind in Illinois, just as a result of the sort of legal certainty about this going forward.
Last week on the 21st, we talked about fracking. We've also talked about the decline of coal in southern Illinois. There's been controversy about drilling for oil in the Arctic and the Dakota Access Pipeline. Where does solar energy fit into all of this as part of our national energy landscape?
Well, I think it's definitely part of the future, and in other parts of the country, it's been developed much more aggressively. I think it depends on the time frame. In the really long run, I think renewables and especially wind and solar will be a large part of the energy mix for the country. Now, whether that's within the next 20 years or next 50 years, that's a matter of policy and how much, you know, government will be incentivizing it. You know, coal is going to get more expensive the harder you have to look for it. And so I think it's going to increase. It's how fast is it's a little bit hard to tell. The other constraint is the electricity grid, because your nuclear and coal energy you can produce when you need it. Solar and wind, you produce it when the sun is out and when the wind blows. And so the storage of that energy and the distribution through the grid is a bit of a technological barrier to really move more aggressively into those renewables.
You mentioned that Illinois' production of solar energy was minute compared to other states. I don't know if I should call them competitors, but for lack of a better word, which other states are doing a better job than we are?
Well, I mean, in part, it's about the local conditions, right? So if you go to Arizona, Texas, and New Mexico, I mean, solar is really what you should be doing. There's plenty of sun, there's plenty of land, and it's very favorable, and that affects the economics. Illinois is, has a fair bit of sun, but it's not the sort of most well-suited state for extensive solar. I think wind is quite attractive, especially in central and southern Illinois. I think there's been a more focused efforts to get solar built up in neighboring states like Indiana, Iowa, for example. Now, there's competition, but I think at this point it's more competition for, generally building up renewables. And I think Illinois was a little bit behind because we didn't have a legal framework for doing this. And so there was a lot of uncertainty, and mm-hmm. the incentives were not terribly well aligned. The bill really made a big difference there, and we're now more in line with what most other states are actually doing.
In spite of the financial incentives, I know change sometimes does not come easy. Are there any misconceptions that you've heard from Illinoisans or Illinois farmers in general about solar power that you'd like to clear up?
No, I mean, solar is really very it's very clean. It's relatively unintrusive. The main concerns are normally just the optics. It doesn't look as pretty as farmland. But there's really no real sort of downside to it, or at least at the local level. It's also not like a wind farm where, you have noise, you have potential intrusion with wildlife. Solar is pretty clean, and it's actually a good neighbor if you want.
Matt, have you been hearing similar things from the farmers that you've talked to as to where solar power fits into this broader context of renewable energies like wind farms or maybe ethanol plants, for instance?
Well, I think when there was a larger push for more development of wind farms in Illinois several years ago, and at one time, there were ethanol plants that seemed like being announced every week or every month a number of years ago, many that didn't get built. There seemed to be a lot more protests to those. I haven't heard of any sort of large-scale movement against a proposed solar installation, and I think it was for a lot of the same reasons that were just mentioned. There's not a noise concern. The largest concern seems to be how's it going to look and, how much land is potentially going to be taken out of production.
Klaus, our weather in Illinois is pretty volatile. We go from thunderstorm to snowstorm to tornado. What impact would that have on solar production of energy?
Yeah, so there's two aspects to it. One is the variability. So you have to obviously build the facilities to withstand strong winds, to withstand potential things like hail. You don't want to really build it in a tornado area, but I think any facility that gets in the way of a tornado will be in trouble. And so I think the present day solar developers are actually quite knowledgeable and savvy about those conditions and build accordingly. The second aspect is, of course, the overall sort of, you know, climate in Illinois, which includes, you know, a fair amount of clouds, rain, snow in the winter if you go a little further north. And so that affects the efficiency and of solar plants and how much you actually get out of them. I don't think either of them are major barriers. You know, I'm originally from Germany, and Germany has one of the largest solar installations in Europe, even though it's probably the worst country for building it there. So it's all about the sort of the will of the local state in this case to actually develop it. And the commercial viability by now with the technology we have today is actually quite good for solar, even in a place like Illinois that is not, you know, Arizona or is not New Mexico.
All right. Thank you both very much. Matt Bedell, reporter with the Peoria Journal-Star, and Klaus Weber, associate professor of management and organizations at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. We appreciate your insights very much, and thank you for being on the 21st.
Thanks for having
Thanks
me.
Thanks so much for having me.
The 21st is made possible by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Propositions on Revolution, Slogans for a Future, part of the campus-wide commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Yvonne Greer in for Nyla Boodoo today. The City of Peoria and its Riverfront Museum are getting a head start in celebrating our state's bicentennial next year. Last week, the museum welcomed a 31-foot-tall painted bronze statue of Abraham Lincoln, and its arrival caused quite a frenzy. John Morris is president and CEO of the Peoria Riverfront Museum. Welcome to The 21st.
Thanks, Yvonne. Good to be with you.
So how did Peoria come to have this statue of Lincoln?
Well, thanks for asking. The Peoria Riverfront Museum, which is a private, not-for-profit museum living in a public building owned by the county, but here, coming up on our fifth anniversary, is always on the lookout to bring exhibitions and collections and programs that enrich the lives and inspire people of all ages in Central Illinois to lifelong learning. It's the only museum of art, science, history, and achievement in the United States. With those four pillars, it's always fun to look for opportunities. So a local man several weeks earlier had given me, mentioned to me the artist Seward Johnson, and said, "You probably don't know Seward Johnson." I said, "Well, yes, I do. I've sort of followed Seward Johnson for years. He is still living, 87-year-old artist of acclaim, really known around the world. I first became familiar with him in 1986 when I was a college student at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. I went out to Haynes Point, which is a public park space in Washington, D.C. It was then. And there was a massive sculpture called The Awakening, which was this giant sort of pushing up out of the soil and kind of fooled the eye. There's a French phrase, trompe l'oeil, which means to fool the eye, and some art does that, and some sculpture does that. And so when this man mentioned this to me, I suggested to our curator, after doing a quick Google search, which is easy to do, finding out there was a foundation in the name of the artist Seward Johnson, and And sure enough, Zach Zetterberg, our assistant curator for art, came back the next day and I said, John, you asked me to contact the foundation. I did. And as it turns out, Chicago has a massive Seward Johnson on exhibition, as they have for the last 6 years. They have had three different what they call monumental pieces of Seward Johnson. One was the farmer and holding the pitchfork and his sister that was blown up to huge painted bronze size. Then they had Marilyn Monroe, based on that famous photograph of Marilyn Monroe sort of holding her dress down over the over the wind grate. And so they had had, since November 1st of last year, a giant statue of President Abraham Lincoln with a modern man holding the Gettysburg Address that Lincoln has just passed on, symbolic of Lincoln passing on to the generations. And sure enough, they offered it to the Peoria Riverfront Museum, or at least offered us an opportunity to come back to them and say whether or not we would want it as it was transitioning out of Chicago. And I said, absolutely. Before actually knowing all that was involved, I said, let's start with the idea that we want it for the people of Peoria. This is the sort of thing that meets our mission, and I think would just be a fun thing. And the idea that that we're getting it off, you know, taking it from Michigan Avenue in Chicago is all the more fun. You know, one of the world's busiest and well-known thoroughfares in Chicago, and bringing it to a place where I think it feels like it has come home, Peoria, Illinois. So,
so the return
visit makes sense to, you know, connect with the bicentennial of Illinois. So
the return visit is 31 feet tall and weighs 19 tons. What was the process of moving it from Michigan Avenue to Peoria like?
Well, the foundation, the Seward Johnson Foundation, says to me, Yvonne, that there would be no charge to bring this, which is remarkable, to lease it, but there would be a charge to transport it, bring it, get the cranes necessary, and so forth. And so a number of donors stepped forward, a number of in-kind contributors stepped forward. We were required to get a massive crane, and Gingrich Crane Company out of Morton donated generously a 240-ton crane to help lift this off of the truck beds that had brought it in. Center State International Trucking here in Peoria donated a truck to go get the modern man, and the truck that transports Lincoln as a specialty truck they have to use for that purpose. So River City Construction donated, along with a host of others, Dewberry, the engineering, for the pad, which turned out to be one of the most expensive parts of the whole thing, was just the pad. It's 4 feet deep, 50 cubic yards of steel-reinforced concrete. It's carefully engineered by Dewberry here to be able to sustain 38,000 pounds, 19 tons of bronze.
I was going to ask about that, because you can't just lift the statue upright and have it stand there.
No, it's a careful process. The Seward Johnson has created the feet of these characters are sort of wider at the bottom, and that the feet are secured to the base. The base itself is actually part of the 19 tons. It's part of the sculpture. It travels with the sculpture. It's actually a part of the artwork, but it's there to help stabilize it. The base weighs about 10 of the 19 tons is in the base of the work of art, so that it's very secure. But as anybody who's seen it, and it's such a joy to see, even in the first day it was in, cars pulling over, people coming up, little kids approaching it, hugging the leg, looking up at it. It's meant to be. It's meant to be approached, and you know, you can sort of knock on the leg if you want and hear the hollow bronze sound of the thing. But most importantly, it I think communicates, Yvonne, great values passed down from Abraham Lincoln to us in the modern age of the Gettysburg Address. And
yes, it has great historical perspective. Lincoln gave his Peoria speech in October of 1854, rather, against slavery and its extension, and that really sort of launched his own political career.
Yeah, that what the Peoria speech represents is the turning point of Abraham Lincoln as an abolitionist. Abraham Lincoln, I don't want to call him a reluctant emancipator. That's unfair, but I don't think that he would have come out. He wasn't a radical abolitionist coming up through politics, but here in Peoria, he really made a turning point, lengthy speech over 3 hours on the courthouse, the old courthouse. Now, of course, we have a new, more modern courthouse, but a book written by Lou Lehrman, Lincoln at Peoria, The Turning Point, is just a superb. I mean, there's been an entire book written on this Lincoln Peoria speech. So if people ask why Lincoln in Peoria, we thought it was a Springfield connection. It most certainly is a Springfield connection. Mm-hmm. Springfield is known as it's the home of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library. I encourage people to visit all the time. And but Peoria has a special, very special niche at being a turning point in Lincoln's political expression, and we should take great pride in that. So we should also take great pride in Illinois, despite our sometimes political dysfunction and issues that people may bring up about the state of Illinois. We are one of the most incredible states in the union, one of the most productive places for agriculture and manufacturing and engineering and invention and education. And there are many, many historical facets of Illinois that we're going to concentrate on in an exhibition, Yvonne, that we're doing mm-hmm. in February of 2018. 200 objects and 200 people that represent the achievements of Illinois. And so this piece, this Seward Johnson massive bronze sculpture out in front of the museum that the community is already enjoying, is really a lead up to helping us celebrate that Lincoln connection to Peoria, as well as the bicentennial of all good things about Illinois.
And what has been some of the community reaction that you've heard outside of the awesome size of the statue?
Well, the day we dedicated it yesterday, at the time of this interview yesterday, it was I was leaving the office about 6:15, and I thought we have a parking garage underneath the museum, free parking for anybody that wants to come visit the museum. We always tell them. And I thought, you know, let me just stroll out there. It's day one. It's standing tall. It's finished. They've taken all the equipment away. I just want to go see what it looks like before I take off for the day. And I walked out there, and I'll bet you there were 30, 40 people gathered. To my absolute surprise, there was a news camera out there. There were people gathered. There were people pulling over. And it really made my whole day as a car drives by and the window's down, and this familiar face yells out on Water Street, "John," he says, "this is awesome." And I look, and it's Preston Jackson, who, as you know, is
another local artist in Peoria.
In his own right, a very famous and well-known, respected artist whose studio is here on Water Street. And it just brought a big smile because he's an artist. He does a lot of work in bronze. And when Preston Jackson yells from the window of his car, "This is awesome," it brought a big smile. But, you know, it's people of amazingly, Yvonne, and this is really, I think, a special credit to who we are in Peoria and Central Illinois and what this museum wants to be. There's a lot said in the last few weeks or months about statues, right? I mean, mm-hmm. statues have been in the news more. Public art has been in the news more, particularly in the South, because of the controversies and the taking down of some public art. Been in the news a great deal. Public art has become a thing of divisiveness in the news media and so forth. But here with this return visit sculpture of Abraham Lincoln standing with the modern common man, I saw people of every possible age range and racial group and gender group. I mean, it was getting out of the car and coming up, bringing their kids, taking a selfie, taking the photographs. This piece is a unifying piece. Lincoln himself, somebody that wanted to hold the Union together, and it's a nice moment, I think, for our museum to stand for the lessons of history, which are positive and uplifting and unifying. And I hadn't really thought of it, to tell you the truth. I probably should have, in the context of public sculpture and so forth. But last night, as I went out there and just saw all these people coming to see this strange thing that has landed in Peoria for 1 year, it will be here on Water Street. It brought a smile to my face.
And a great reason for people to take a trip to Peoria, yes?
I think so, and you know, there's hundreds of other reasons why they're here. So, but I think this one, Yvonne, will stir the imaginations of folks. And I tell you, I've seen sculpture all over the country and in other parts of the world. And there are great classical sculptures, and there are, you know, this is not Michelangelo's David, but this is a fun piece of sculpture, really unlike in size and scope, and the way he uses a special paint technique to bond the paint to the bronze. It's unlike really anything people are going to have ever seen, probably. So
certainly, in its size, it's awe-inspiring. And I wonder, Otto, as just someone who's seen it, that it's not just Lincoln. There is a common man, and Lincoln is explaining to him the Gettysburg Address because the man's holding a copy. It's almost like the artist Seward Johnson wanted us to be able to see ourselves in that sculpture to talk about how we are connected to our history and to our political leaders.
He really, that's exactly what, and that's why at the dedication ceremony we took the time out to actually read the words of the Gettysburg Address. And we thought that was important because that's really what Seward Johnson wanted, was to pass along the meaning in those words and how it might help us today. And so the man standing with Abraham Lincoln is just every man. He has no name. He has no, you know, there's some characteristics about him which are interesting. He's middle-aged. He's wearing corduroys and tennis shoes and a pink shirt with a what do they call it? Cable sweater, and it's circa 1990. 91 was when he finished the smaller version of this piece, which is at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. It was a commission by Gettysburg asked Seward Johnson to do this piece so that they could have a piece to connect to the tourists coming in to see Gettysburg and to connect to the Gettysburg Address. It was in 2014, just 2014, that this monumental piece, as he classifies it, monumental piece, 31 foot tall, was finished after 3 years of work that he and his studio did on it. So return visit comes really from the notion of Lincoln coming back to Gettysburg when he did the original commission. It's mm-hmm. the same name for the monumental piece. But return visit, Yvonne, also has kind of a nice connotation to just returning to history. History is about the present. It informs the present and inspires the future. And as a museum, we encourage people to study and learn from the objects, the stories the objects of history tell us.
And not much to say after that. John Morris, President and CEO of the Peoria Riverfront Museum, congratulations on acquiring the return visit for 2 years as the state of Illinois gets ready to celebrate its bicentennial next year. Thank you so much for being with us on the 21st.
Yvonne, keep up the great work. You're one of our finest communicators in this community. It's an honor to be on your program.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Yvonne Greer in for Nyla Boodoo today. More than 3 million women have served in the military since the American Revolution. But historically, they may not have received the recognition they deserve. For the past 20 years, the people behind a memorial for women in military service at Arlington National Cemetery in Washington, D.C., have been trying to change that. To help us learn more about these efforts, I'm joined now by two retired lieutenant colonels. On the line from Washington, D.C., Marilla Cushman. She's the Director of Public Relations and Development for Women in Military Service for America Memorial. And on the line from Bloomington is Jill Henry, who volunteers as an ambassador for the Women's Memorial. Marilla, Jill, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Yvonne.
Thank you for having us.
So, Marilla, you've been a part of the Women's Memorial almost since its inception. What was the initial vision for the project?
Well, actually, the initial vision for the project was a group of World War II women from Ohio, actually. This was sort of around the time when the Vietnam Women's Memorial was being established and built. And so they kind of questioned, well, what about us? And then Congresswoman Mary Rose Okar, she was out to at a ceremony for a plaque that they were putting in. And in a cemetery there. So they approached Mary Rose Okar and asked her, well, what about us? And she said, well, surely, you're included in all of the other memorials. And they said no. And she had her staff look, and indeed, you probably wouldn't know a woman served if you looked at our war memorials around the country. So that's kind of the inception of it, was the World War II women themselves. And, about 400,000 women served during World War II.
Wow, that's jaw-dropping.
It is.
Jill, for someone like me who's not been to Arlington National Cemetery and hasn't seen this memorial, can you paint the picture for us? What is your experience when you first walk in?
Well, when you first walk in, you have to realize when you look at it, it's at the ceremonial entrance to Arlington National Cemetery. So as you go down the main road, we're the first thing that you see. And the actual beginning, the wall that you see has actually been there and was dedicated in 1932. So that part of it has been there for quite some time. But what we did, we took over that area and made the memorial. I think they dug out the earth behind it and then built the building behind it. And it's beautiful. And it was restored. And glass ceiling is on the top of it. And so it's beautiful from the outside, very serene. And because behind it, you can see all the graves. And then up on the hill, you see, Robert E. Lee's home. So, yes, they wanted to maintain the same feeling.
Got it.
And actually, if you would like me to, Jill, I can speak to that glass ceiling, because indeed it was it is an arc of glass tablets that forms the skylight down into the memorial itself, and we refer to it as an arc of glass tablets because interspersed throughout those are 13 quotations by or about military women. And as the sun passes over the memorial, those quotations reflect down on the marble wall into the exhibit gallery.
Ooh, that just gave me goosebumps.
So it is beautiful. And indeed, if you spoke to the architects, they would say yes. That was their vision, that it symbolizes, the glass ceiling, as well as the stairwells that go up to that terrace where you can actually see the glass and read the glass tablets as symbolizing breaking through the barriers and the glass ceiling.
Yeah, that's what's really fabulous to me is you can walk basically on our roof and you can read these quotes from the top, but when you're inside the building, like she said, when the sun comes in, you can read those reflections on the wall when you're inside.
Are there any of those reflections that stood out for you or hit home for you or resonated?
There is a beautiful quotation by actually a World War II Army nurse who served in the China-Burma-India theater. And when she wrote this, she was reflecting on some fellow nurses who were killed when they were, you know, flying the Himalayas, flying the hump. And they buried their bodies in a camellia grove there in Burma. And so she's reflecting about that burial, and she says, "Let the generations know that women in uniform also guaranteed their freedom, that our resolve was just as great as the brave men who stood amongst us, and our tears fell just as hard. Right. There you go. Thank you so much.
Our tears fell just as hard
as those we left behind us. And that's kind of the mission of the memorial. Let the generations know that women in uniform also guaranteed their freedom."
Wow. The memorial has what, some 260,000 female veterans registered so far?
I looked it up just before we started this, and it is exactly 262,838 women's records of service are registered with the Women's Memorial.
Can you give us a sense of their demographic makeup? Are these veterans who are done with their service? Are there people who are still in active duty?
They span all categories. Some of them are from the American Revolution to today's women, serving in Afghanistan or on a ship at sea. But indeed, they truly tell the story of women's service to the nation.
And there's a special section just for women who've lost their lives in Afghanistan and Iraq.
We have a specific room that we call the Hall of Honor. And in the Hall of Honor is where we pay specific tribute to the women who've given their lives in service to the nation. And we have a book there in the Hall of Honor has the registrations or the stories and pictures of every one of the women, which is totals 166 at this time, who've lost their lives in Afghanistan and Iraq. Yes, it is a special place. In that room as well is a sister block to the Tomb of the Unknown that was donated to us by the quarry that provided the stone for the Tomb of the Unknown. So it is there sort of as a sentinel, kind of watching over the Women's Memorial as well. So we're very proud to have that.
Let's talk for a moment, if we may, about your service. Jill, I'm going to come back to you for a moment. You were in active duty for more than 20 years as an Army nurse, and several months of that time were spent in Saudi Arabia during Desert Storm. Can you share with us what that experience was like for you?
Well, I was, deployed, and I actually thought I was going to get through my career all stateside, and then Desert Storm came up. And so sure enough, I went, and I was a Profus filler at the time. I was a certified registered nurse anesthetist. So I got attached to a hospital out of Fort Polk, and we trained there for a good month probably before we deployed. And, we got there. I think one of the hardest things was just not really knowing what was going to happen. We weren't told much at all. We just kind of took it day by day, hour by hour. And then we were set up in the middle of the desert. We didn't really know where we were. Nothing was around at all. Very disorienting to see nothing but flat desert. And we set up our hospital. And I was with the 15th Evacuation Hospital. And there was actually a reserve evac hospital fairly close to us within walking distance. And we didn't have, we were busy at times. Most of our patients ended up being EPWs, or enemy prisoners of war. We had some, you know, American soldiers from that 100-hour war. But, you know, we also had children, which we kind of weren't expecting, you know. But because we took care of a lot of civilians and all, you know, we had a variety of everything. After the war was over, then we packed everything up, cleaned it up, and headed home.
And what made you decide to register for the memorial yourself?
Well, it was when it was, you know, I really don't remember how I heard about it. I'm a charter member, so I believe there was a certain time frame that you needed to register in order to be called a charter member. So I kind of remember thinking, oh, I need to sign up so I can be a charter member or register. And so I've just was interested. I mean, it's there for me. It's there for all women veterans. And in order for us to tell our story, because truly, I think women have been the unsung patriots, you know, in our military heritage, because there just wasn't anything much out there to tell our stories. So so I've been on, you know, the mailing list all this time, and it's been fabulous since the, you know, the Facebook page has come out, because there's a lot of things, very interesting things. I'm learning a lot of military history, you know, through the Facebook page, and so I love that. And just want to spread the word. I know there are, now that I've been an ambassador, I have talked to many women who didn't even know that this existed. I mean, old and young alike. So we need to get the word out there and get the future and current generations educated and empowered by this wonderful memorial that's there for them.
And Marilla, how do we get people to do that? How can they go about doing that? If they haven't
that
already.
Thank you for asking that. And thank you, Jill, for that great endorsement. It is an extraordinary place, and it is where we, our story is told. Easy to do online at www.womensmemorial.org. Click on the icon for register, and everything can be done online. You can also give us a call at 703-533-1155, and we can send you a registration form. But it's easy to do. We ask the woman to send a picture of herself in uniform, tell us a little bit about her service, her dates of service, her awards and decorations, and that all goes into an interactive database that. That visitors will see for all time, actually, when they visit the memorial, and it is pretty. It is very moving to have a family come in, or a kid coming in with a school vacation, whose mom or sister or whomever may be deployed or in the military, and she keys in her name, and up pops her mom or whatever, and certainly she is the hero of the day, but it's a wonderful way to pay tribute. We have the same thing with folks who come in whose moms may have served in World War I or World War II or Vietnam, or a woman who's looking for a colleague, somebody that she served with, a battle buddy or a shipmate. So it is a very moving experience to see that happen.
And we've got just a couple of minutes left. Your words of wisdom to a woman who may say to herself, well, that time has passed. I don't want to go back and remember it. Maybe it's not important that I register. You would say to her?
I would say to her that every woman's service, every woman's service is important to the nation, and her contributions to that service and to the nation are enormously important, this is the place where that's told.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel Marilla Cushman and Jill Henry, thank you both so much for being with us on the 21st. Do know that we're going to tweet out all the information about the memorial and how to register for it. So if you follow us at the 21st Show on Twitter, we'll also have that information available on the website at 21stshow.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having an interest in this topic. Really appreciate it.
That's all we have time for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montesilio, Bob Holly, and Sean Newman. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Yvonne Greer, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.